Coming up on Fronteras, there's a growing Muslim presence in at least one town on the U.S.-Mexico border.
I never thought I'm going to live in Mexico, honestly. All these reasons come from God, and we thank Allah.
Islam is making inroads in the Latino community. When it comes to the controversial unmanned aircraft known as drones, business is booming, and that could mean scores of new jobs for San Diego. But privacy defenders say that courting the drone industry could cost us our civil liberties.
If they're going to fly, 10,000 drones around Southern California, what are they going to do with all that surveilling information?
The controversial drone industry. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local journalism center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. When it comes to the controversial unmanned aircraft known as drones, business is booming. More drones are proposed as part of a border security package to secure immigration reform. And states across the Southwest, Texas, New Mexico, California, and Arizona are all competing to be named one of six new drone research centers. San Diego is in the forefront of that competition, but some there say courting the drone industry could cost us our civil liberties.
Imagine swarms of drones hovering over most of Southern California. The thought makes a lot of residents uneasy, but it's exactly what Sean Barr of the San Diego Regional Economic Development Corporation hopes to see. Barr has been working with a coalition of defense industry advocates to brand San Diego as the drone capital of the world. To ensure that drone makers put down stakes in San Diego, Barr and his allies are trying to convince the FAA to base a lucrative drone test site here. The range they're envisioning would be expansive.
It extends from the China Lake Edwards Air Force Base area west to the ocean, south to the Mexican border, and then east to the Arizona border.
When people like Dave Patterson of San Diego Veterans for Peace hear about Barr's plans, they don't picture a new economic golden age. They foresee an Orwellian police state.
If they're going to fly, 10,000 drones around Southern California, what are they going to do with all that surveilling information?
The legal boundaries aren't clear yet, but Barr's coalition remains focused on securing drone jobs for San Diego. Similar efforts have been hatched in Nevada and in Oklahoma and North Dakota and New York and Maryland and Massachusetts. The FAA has received over 50 test site proposals since February. Barr thinks San Diego can beat the competition. He estimates that about 7,000 local jobs are already dedicated to drones. Then there's San Diego's weather, ideal for year-round flight testing. Not to mention its large military presence. With law enforcement, scientists, and farmers all coveting this technology, Barr thinks San Diego's drone economy is poised to double within this decade.
There is an opportunity for it to grow significantly.
Representative Duncan D. Hunter sees that opportunity too. His district relies on jobs tied to two of the world's biggest drone developers, Northrop Grumman and General Atomics. During a recent visit to Northrop Grumman's Rancho Bernardo facilities, Congressman Hunter marveled at the futuristic machines being developed in San Diego.
Everybody's going to be looking to you and to be looking at us here to see what is the next thing. What's it going to be in 20 years? What's it going to be in 25 years till we get to, Terminator 3 when we don't have to do anything?
The machines, they're starting to take over.
But frankly, that's probably where it's going.
And where it's going troubles the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties. Legal Director David Loy argues that drones aren't properly regulated yet, threatening our privacy, civil liberties, and even our lives.
We have very serious concerns about the government targeting American citizens for killing far from any battlefield without any form of due process at all.
The ACLU argues that these targeted killings, reportedly responsible for hundreds of civilian deaths in the Middle East, set a dangerous precedent. Even local drone industry boosters like Congressman Hunter worry about this technology.
Part of being an American is being able to do what you want to do without having people looking at you or questioning you. And I think that that plays right into the UAV conflict that we're going to have because, yes, it's going to be good for jobs. It could be steps forward in the way that we handle wildfires and the way that we have police chases and the way that we do a lot of things. But the downsides, especially when it comes to privacy, I think are fairly great.
San Diego Veterans for Peace have been protesting outside a General Atomics facility in Poway every week for the past 7 months.
Our Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights are going to go up in the cloud of drones if we're not careful.
Despite these concerns, Sean Barr's Economic Development Coalition says drone jobs are coming to the U.S. no matter what, and San Diego should be the region to reap the economic rewards. The ACLU's David Loy thinks that focusing on where drones are made is beside the point.
Wherever the drones are manufactured, the issue is how are they being used?
In San Diego, I'm David Wagner.
Another story from San Diego today focuses on education. About a quarter of California's public schools students are learning English as a second language. But by middle and high school, more than half of those students have not mastered English. Kyla Calvert reports some San Diego schools have new classes this year that aim to put an end to this trend of long-term English learners.
Desiree Valve was born here in 1998, but she hasn't spent all of her school years in San Diego.
My mom took me over in another country when I was young, that's why. I had to visit my sisters in the Philippines, and then we got stuck in there, so my aunt had to help me out and stuff. To come back.
She came back in 2006, but despite 7 years in San Diego schools, there are still some things the 15-year-old has trouble with in English.
My paragraphs, like putting in sentences, putting in my own words, that's kind of difficult for me. Like putting in past tense and which word is better to add to the sentences, that's kind of like slowing me down a little bit. The rest is easy. It's just the writing.
Her struggles are familiar to California's long-term English learners, tens of thousands of whom have spent all of their school years in the U.S. But this year, things are starting to change for Valve, thanks to a new class she's taking with a dozen other students.
We have other vocabulary that we can use. We could replace boy and girl with a better, precise word, a word that's clearer.
Linda Levine teaches the class called Academic Language Development. She works with students on improving vocabulary, sentence structure, and understanding the components of different kinds of academic writing.
They'll sit and they'll chat with me and, you know, they're they're okay and they communicate with each other. But it's when they have to sit down and talk about text and academically being able to pull that all together and pull their ideas together.
Typically, they're students that have been in our district since kinder, first grade. They're pushing into middle school or high school, is still designated as English learners.
That's Mary Waldron. She heads the district's Office of Language Acquisition and is overseeing the introduction of these language development classes at 11 city schools this year. She says about 6,000 of San Diego Unified's more than 35,000 English learners are long-term English learners. They haven't passed the state's English proficiency test despite being in public schools for 6 years or more. Waldron says the goals of the new courses extend beyond improving students' language skills.
We certainly want to see some improvement in their academic skills, both within the pilot course and then in their other courses, too. Just an increase in their self-confidence and their ability to apply what they're learning.
So what we're able to see is how exactly what we're doing in this class is transferring over to English and what we're learning in English class.
Levine is seeing that kind of progress in the mainstream English classes where she teaches the same students and in their other classes.
And they were in a science class together and a student said, well, he didn't use our language frames, or they would be catching me when I wasn't using mine. And so we started to see that bleed over not only into English but into other classes as well. And so then in their writing, same thing.
Once Levine's lesson is over, student Ricardo Mondragon points out some of those language frames posted on the classroom wall.
It tells us, if we want to have, more educated words or, academic words over there. If we want to disagree, we say, I disagree with, and then whatever.
These may not seem like complicated lessons, but evidence is mounting that targeted strategies like this can make a big difference. Escondido Union High School District has been lauded for long-term English learner classes like these and getting those students into classes like Spanish for Native Speakers and AP courses. Those efforts are paying off. the district's percentage of English learners passing into fluency has outpaced state and county averages consistently since 2003. Desiree Valvet says she can see the focus on academic language skills making a difference in her mainstream English class.
Last year, I got a B, but now I have an A+, so my uncle is happy with that.
Between 200 and 250 San Diego Unified students are in one of this year's pilot language classes. But Waldron says other principals want to bring the classes to their campuses, and similar courses are likely to grow outside of San Diego schools as well. Starting next year, the state will report to districts how many of their students are long-term English learners. In San Diego, I'm Kyla Calvert.
Still more Fronteras coming up. There's a growing Muslim presence in at least one town on the U.S.-Mexico border.
I never thought I'm going to live in Mexico, honestly. All these reasons come from God, and we thank Allah.
Islam's making inroads in the Latino community. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Mexico is a predominantly Catholic country, but the border city of Tijuana has always hosted a more diverse population of worshippers. In the last few years, one of the largest religions in the world has begun making inroads there. Brooke Binkowski reports on a small population of Muslims, many of them recent converts who made Tijuana their home.
It's a quarter after six in Playas, a Tijuana neighborhood about a mile south of the U.S.-Mexico border. A dozen or so people have gathered at a nondescript building next to a small grocery store to pray. The building is a mosque called Masjid al-Islam. It opened just over 2 years ago to give the estimated 200 Muslims in Baja California a place to worship. It's one of two new mosques in Tijuana. There are people from all over the world attending this mosque. They're here from India, Costa Rica, the Middle East, and of course Mexico and the U.S. They're all bumped up against the border here, many stuck waiting for visas, or in recent years, caught up in the net of the United States' ever more aggressive deportation policies. Amir Carr is a native Californian and a convert to Islam.
It changed my life. You know, I was a street kid. You know, I got put in this wheelchair for hanging out with gangs and stuff like this. And I got shot. And for the first time I sat down in my life and listened. And when I listened to Islam, it actually changed my life.
After Carr got out of prison in California, his wife Naima, a Mexican national, was deported. So he moved to Tijuana to be with her. That was 5 years ago. They've been here ever since.
They pulled us over for speeding, and they deported her within about an hour. It was so quick that you just couldn't even believe it.
Samuel Cortez, another convert, grew up in Glendale. He was deported after spending time in prison for aggravated assault.
I started gang banging when I was 9. I stopped when I was 21. When I decided to put that aside, if it wasn't other gang members from other neighborhoods that were trying to kill me, it was my own neighborhood that was trying to come after me because I wanted to change my life.
Cortez says he's settled down since he arrived in Tijuana. He got married and now has a baby daughter.
I go to work and I come home and I don't have to worry about anything else. I left everything back there and that's fine. I mean, hopefully one day, you know, I can get my visa, go back and forth and just visit my family. But for the time being, I'm just mostly concentrated on my daughter, Islam, and work.
Cortez and Carr are part of what the Council for American Islamic Relations says is the fastest growing number of post-9/11 converts in the U.S. In 2011, Latinos made up 12% of all converts, up from 6% in 2000. Dr. Khalil Mohammed is a professor of Islamic and religious studies at San Diego State University. He believes the relatively high rate of Latino converts is due to the influence of the Roman Catholic Church.
The Catholic emphasis on family and family values meshes a lot with Islam. The difference, however, is that whereas many Catholics see the Roman Catholic values being eroded, a lot of them are seen in Islam, a difference that there are more Muslims trying to stick to the traditional Islamic values and leave them aside.
Combine a growing number of converts with the stricter immigration controls and you end up with a growing Muslim presence in Tijuana. Muhana Jamaluddin is the imam, or spiritual leader, of Masjid al-Islam. He was born in Ramallah in the Palestinian territories.
He, too, followed a winding path to Tijuana, moving here from the U.S. with his wife after she lost her visa.
I never thought I'm going to live in Mexico, honestly. All these reasons come from God, and we thank Allah.
Amir Carr says many deported Muslims end up staying in Mexico rather than trying to get back into the United States because he claims it's much easier to be openly Muslim here.
When we open a masjid here, they don't even blink. They look with curiosity, and they ask. For sure they don't march. I mean, for sure they don't. Nothing negative comes out of them. They just accept it as they would accept anybody else.
Back at the mosque, among the international crowd of worshippers, there's also converts from within Mexico. At least half, says the imam. Services are offered here in English, Arabic, and Spanish. Reporting from Playa, Tijuana, I'm Brooke Binkowski.
Traditional immigration lore in America involves Ellis Island or the San Francisco Gold Rush, maybe even a pilgrim crossing. But new Americans, such as the growing population of Mexican-American immigrants, have different and equally vivid stories. Stories of relatives swimming to better opportunities across the Rio Grande or crossing the desert at night. Yes, those crossings are illegal, but they also are part of a family's history and growing demographics new immigration lore. From the Northwest News Network in Washington State, correspondent Anna King reports.
I met Antonio at a poetry performance competition. He recited Bent to the Earth by Blas Manuel de Luna. The poem relates a story of Mexicans trying to get into the U.S. and getting stopped by the Border Patrol. As each word rolled out of him, Antonio's face told me this was more than just a meaningful poem. This was his life.
I was a child who had seen what a piece of polished wood could do to a face, who had seen his mother about to lose the one he loved, who had lost some friends, who would never return, who later that morning bent to the earth and went to work.
We're not using Antonio's real name because of his parents' legal status. He's 17. His parents leave for work early and get back late. He sports $10 white sneakers and a blithesome smile. We're in his house. 2 rooms, 1 bathroom, 6 people, 1 baby. Sometimes on Saturday mornings, Antonio says they gather around hot chocolate and cookies and his parents tell stories. Here's one. On his mother's trip from Mexico, her group had to cross the desert. It was hot in the day and very cold at night.
They went over a river, and so they were really wet. And on their clothes, you know, if they kept their clothes on, they were going to freeze overnight. So they ended up, my mom told me, they had to take, you know, all their clothes off except their underwear just so they wouldn't freeze to death.
Antonio knows that these stories of overcoming adversity are important to his family. He has his own stories of sleeping in cars, but his younger brothers and sisters, including his baby brother, are farther away from those crossing stories. They've only ever known a roof overhead and new shoes. He worries as he gets older.
And maybe I'd lose those traditions altogether. I wouldn't hate to lose, you know, being who I am.
Across the Columbia Basin, in another small town called Mabton, I meet a family who also has a dramatic border crossing story.
No, mijo, tengo mucho tiempo que no te veo, dijo.
Luis Vargas is some storyteller. His eyes open wide, and his voice, sometimes down to a whisper, relates the drama. He has huge scars to prove his tale. One runs long, flat, from mid-chest to his belly button. Another runs along the inside of his left arm. His daughter, Maria Rodriguez, translates as Vargas tells the story. He was packed into a 1968 Chevy truck with 6 others, shoulder to shoulder, like sardines. A coyote, or human smuggler, was at the wheel, U.S. bound. They passed through a checkpoint, but soon after, a State Patrol officer spotted the men in the truck.
The State Patrol, you know, follows the coyote right away. So they're literally doing a too fast, too furious kind of races, you know, back side to side. And the patrolman is on the side with a speaker, you know, telling them, pull over, pull over.
The coyote smuggler tries to make a tight turn at high speeds, but his back wheels go off an embankment, and then the truck starts to tumble.
So then my dad says that he remembers most of the men flew off because, you know, of course, they're going downhill. And my dad said he still managed to bounce up and land on the truck again. But the second time that he did manage to bounce off, he actually, his stomach ended up landing on a ginormous rock. And he says he remembers laying there, and he goes, you know how in the cartoons when someone lands and there's always the little stars floating around? He goes, I swear to you, he goes, I saw stars.
Maria Rodriguez says she wants her descendants to always remember her father's stories. But she admits it's going to be hard to keep them relevant to American-born generations.
Kids are born into money, but I'm actually glad I was born poor. Or how should I always say, U.S. poor, as they say? Because when you know that you don't have something and when you finally get it, you appreciate it.
For his part, 17-year-old Antonio is grateful for the life his parents have given him. He says maybe it's natural. The stories may fade after generations.
And I think they really want us to know what it's like. You know, they want us to know that even though they can't offer us the world, they offer, you know, they give us more than they could have ever wished for.
His parents may never earn much more than minimum wage, but the story's not finished. Antonio hopes to become a biomedical engineer. A junior, he's already won a couple of scholarships for college. In Mabton, Washington, I'm Anna King.
That story comes to us from the Northwest News Network. You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting funded journalism project. We cover the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversations and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.